This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Molly Ivins, is a syndicated political columnist based in Austin, Texas, who is known for her outspoken views and biting wit. She wrote about George W. Bush when he was the governor of Texas, and she's continued to write about him as president. She's a critic of the president, and she explains why in her new book, Bushwhacked: Life in George W. Bush's America. It's co-authored with Lou Dubose, with whom she also wrote the 1999 bestseller Shrub about Bush's years as governor. Her book, Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She?, was also a bestseller. Ivins is the former co-editor of the Texas Observer. Now, you're in an interesting position living in Texas and having followed George W. Bush's career as governor of that state. You can see some of the things that he accomplished in Texas that he's patterning programs on as president of the United States. Can we talk about a couple of those?
Sure.
One of the biggest domestic stories in the Bush administration is his tax cuts. And you watched him preside over tax cuts in Texas. What was the extent of the tax cuts there?
They were very large by our standards. When Bush came into office in 94, he inherited a very tidy surplus from his predecessor and promptly gave tax cuts to property owners. And then having done that once, he went back and did it again. And as a consequence, the state was left with no money in its rainy day fund, that is to say, nothing in a savings account. And when we got hit with the economic downturn along with everybody else, there was the state stony broke with nothing in reserve. And we wound up having to whack $10 billion out of what nobody has ever considered a generous budget.
What have the repercussions been? Have there been cuts in services? I mean, what?
Oh, absolutely. And unfortunately, it was done in such a almost heartbreaking way. Texas is not generous with social services. We're lucky to be a step ahead of Mississippi. We wound up cutting from children, old people, and sick people.
What kind of programs?
Children's health insurance program, home care for the elderly. We just hit all the social services. But God bless Texas. At least we're still maintaining a healthy business climate.
When you're looking at the proposals to further cut tax cuts in America, what do you think about regarding Texas?
Well, again, there's an old country western song called Lubbock on Everything. And sometimes I think that what we are now watching is Texas on Everything. It's as though W had gone to Washington to spread the great gospel of the Lone Star State all over the entire country. And it's always been my observation. I think that Texas is the national laboratory for bad government. Every nutty idea that's ever been thought of has been tried here and generally proved to be absolutely worthless. And to watch Bush take these same ideas to Washington and try to replicate them nationwide makes me wonder why the other 49 states haven't just seceded.
You write that one casualty of the budget crash is the state's public schools, and you're talking about Texas here.
Right.
And education has been very important to President Bush as president of the United States. Is he trying to replicate anything nationally that he tried in Texas as governor?
Oh, absolutely. One of his great claims to fame was the Texas education miracle. And he particularly emphasized standards, testing. What's interesting is, of course, that indeed Texas public schools have improved since the 1970s. And many governors have struggled with this over the years, and particularly the problem of equitable school financing, because the state was hauled into court and this long-running lawsuit was finally ruled against the state and said that we were just doing a terrible job of balancing the way we pay for schools. So that was a huge struggle in the legislature, culminating in something called the Robin Hood Plan, in theory taking from the rich and giving to the poor. And I must say there was some improvement. And when I wrote about Bush in 2000 during the presidential campaign, I said, look, you know, this guy's record is mostly either not impressive or depressing, but there is this one bright spot. He really is interested in education. He really understands the issue, and he put a lot of time and energy into it. I didn't know at the time, and in the new book, we report that what had appeared to be significant advances in education in Texas, improving scores, and just a general upward trend, turned out to have been, heartbreakingly enough, slightly fraudulent. What happened was we were getting higher scores by increasing the dropout rate, which, depending on which study you believe, may be somewhere short of 40%, which is really pretty ugly. And what you're seeing, for example, students have to be tested in 4th and 9th grade, or 10th grade. And so at the high school level, you have kids who remain in high school for 3 years as technical 9th graders. They're never allowed to advance because they would lower the school's cumulative score. And this kind of sort of cheating, for lack of a better word, let's just call it cheating, was, of course, provoked by these requirements laid on public schools by the state without sufficient funds to back them up. In other words, they were told, perform, do better, but not given any wherewithal to do better. And there you are again. It's exactly the same thing at the national level. I mean, Bush's first big play was the education bill called No Child Left Behind. And Senator Edward Kennedy worked with the administration on that. And they came up with, you know, a plan to, again, standards, testing. Let's see the results. Let's find out how these kids are doing. And then Bush refused to fully fund what he had committed to with Kennedy in the course of negotiating for that bill. There's no use demanding higher standards of schools unless you give them something to work with.
Now, you're implying that schools are just as happy that the kids who score low drop out because then the school looks better on the standardized test scores.
I am more than implying that. I'm stating that.
And why would the schools want the kids out to make the test scores look better?
Well, if you're the principal of a school that doesn't meet the standards of the state, you know, a sufficient number of kids pass the test so that you get approval, then, among other things, you're fired, you're gone.
So how does this system that you're describing in Texas compare to what's being put in place in the U.S.?
Well, the No Child Left Behind Act, you will find if you talk to educators around the country, is being found to have serious drawbacks, and a whole lot of hell is being raised about it on a lot of different levels. But I think, it comes back to the fact that you demand more of the schools without giving them any more resources.
If you're just joining us, my guest is syndicated columnist Molly Ivins. She is a native of Texas, continues to live there. Her new book is called Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. You write about the president's religion, and you say, while you acknowledge that, you know, religion is usually off limits for the press to write about, you think it's important to bring it up in the case of President Bush. Why?
Well, I think that George W. Bush, unlike his father, his dad, George Bush, was clearly a sort of upper-class Eastern WASP. W is really consciously, culturally identified as a Texan. And you see in his character sort of three common strands of Texas culture. One is religiosity, anti-intellectualism, and machismo. And all three of them are very appealing to broad groups of voters. And I think in Bush's case, at least with the first two, absolutely genuine. I think the religiosity is genuine, and And I think it needs to be looked at, as I say, mostly religion, pretty much, yeah, you know, you leave it out of pace. But to the extent that his religious beliefs influence policy, which they do at several intersections, then I think it's legitimate to take a look at it.
Now, in Bushwhacked, you describe the Bush administration as driven by ideology. What do you see as the ideology that drives it?
The ideology of this administration. There's an extent to which I did not think Bush as governor, while I'm very conservative, but you understand conservative in a sort of Texas, I don't know how to explain this, there's a certain kind of provincialism. I believe that provincialism is a universal characteristic, but I must admit, Texas is even more universal in that regard than most. When, you know, there's a kind of Midland Petroleum Club mentality that Bush has had all along. I mean, he literally, the first time he ever ran for public office, he ran for Congress in 1978 on the grounds that Jimmy Carter was leading us toward European-style socialism. I mean, just Jimmy Carter, the very Baptist Jimmy Carter. But Bush himself, as a political operator, didn't seem to me as governor terribly ideologically motivated. He was on some issues, death penalty, some others you couldn't move him on. But basically, he was, you know, flexible enough to play the game with the powers that then were in the legislature. And I think Bush has always chosen, you know, these older male mentors. And his pick on his way to Washington was Dick Cheney, who is really quite ideological. If you go back, political reporters are great believers in look at the record, look at the record. If you check Cheney's political record as a voting member of Congress, you'll find it's really quite extraordinary. He was often one of only one, two, or a handful of votes opposed to what would normally be considered, you know, the legislative equivalent of voting in favor of a resolution commending motherhood. And I think that part of what has happened is that Washington is such a polarized place, and there genuinely is the people who call themselves movement conservatives, who really genuinely subscribe to the ideology that government is bad, the marketplace will solve all problems, we're much better off, you know, with unfettered capitalism, no government, just let the marketplace solve everything. And that I think that's almost like a religious belief rather than a political belief. It seems to be an article of faith with many of these people. Undeterred by reality, experience, the record, or anything else. And so it seems to me that Bush has actually become more ideological since he's gone to Washington, particularly to the extent that he, and this is a really elementary political mistake. I can't believe Karl Rove, who's a very smart guy, is really letting this happen. It seems to me the mistake is that they're only listening to one another, that there is a sort of loop of insiders, and I mentioned Rumsfeld and Cheney and all that circle of people. They're just talking to each other, and they're not hearing from anyone outside the circle, which is always a fatal mistake.
My guest is syndicated columnist Molly Ivins, co-author of the new book Bushwhacked. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is syndicated columnist Molly Ivins. In your book, Bushwhacked, you're critical of the Washington Press Corps.
Very.
What's your problem with the Washington Press Corps?
Oh, man. Let me count the ways. One thing is I do find it conformist and pompous and self-important to a level that I find nearly unbearable. One of the things that annoys me about Washington, I should point this out, is not just that it's a city where everybody says exactly what everybody else says. I mean, truly, they are like blackbirds. But when I go to Washington, instead of coming in and saying, well, y'all, I am fresh in from the prairies of Texas, and I'm here to tell you that you're full of whatever, I'm not there for more than 10 minutes before I find myself saying exactly what everybody else says. That really drives me crazy, and it's the reason I avoid the town. But I do think that the press has been let itself be led around by the nose for quite a long time. I think during the Clinton era, we were goaded by political enemies of Clinton into devoting far too much time and attention to utterly unimportant and inane episodes like Filegate and Travelgate and Whitewater, which Lord knows have been investigated until the end of time and still no evidence of wrongdoing. And that constant sort of, you know, big scandal stuff. And then, oddly enough, when Bush came in, and I certainly had had enough scandal mongering during the Clinton administration, and I had absolutely no desire to see the same thing done to George W. when he took over. And I think that Bush got a fair honeymoon from the press corps. And then, of course, both because of September 11th and, you know, we always rally behind the president in a national crisis, and we always rally behind the president in wars, and a war in Afghanistan, a war in Iraq. So there was just, you know, a long period of rallying there. And I think it is only now that many people are standing back and looking at the result of Bush's policies. And particularly, and what our book is about, the effect of those policies on people's lives. And what's astonishing about what we found when we went out and reported this, well, it was really astonishing to me because I'm a political reporter. You would think that I would think it was the most important thing in the whole world. That government. If you had told us, I think, when we started this book, that a change in government policy, and we're talking about low-level stuff, where it never made the headlines, it never made the television news. This is all just boring, regular, you know, little change in regulation, a little executive order, a little funding cut, nothing very dramatic. So basically we're talking about the regulatory equivalent of changing subsection B in Article 2 of the Interstate Dilly-Dally Compact. And if you had told us when we started that people would actually die because of some of these decisions, I mean, dramatically said, it's a matter of life and death, we would have said, oh, please stop being so overdramatic, get a grip. And dang if we didn't find exactly that. Mm-hmm. People dying as a direct result of minor regulatory changes.
What's an example of one?
We have two in the book. One was the Clinton administration had planned to introduce something called microbial testing as a way of doing meat and poultry inspection. And this was to get away from the old sort of, you know, improve on the old scratch and sniff method. In other words, federal meat inspectors are in most meatpacking and poultry processing plants, and their job is to go around, and if they see anything that looks and smells really bad, they're supposed to stop the line. And this system was clearly not entirely perfect. As you know, we have outbreaks of disease from time to time. And so they were going to put in this microbial testing thing, a new, more kind of high-tech way of making sure that meat and poultry are safe. Well, the reality is that most meat and poultry processors are based in the red states, so-called red states, and they're very large donors to the Republican Party. And so when Bush came in, they simply put the kibosh on the proposed Clinton plan and went back to the old system. And so we traced an outbreak of listeriosis to one of the people who died as a result of it. In Philadelphia, we found it was Philadelphia, your hometown. Very cold winter last year, as you know. And one of the things that Bush had specifically promised to protect was a government program called LIHEAP, that stands for Low Income Heating Assistance Program. And during a presidential debate with Gore in Boston, Bush specifically said, and one of the things we'll do is fully fund LIHEAP, which is a program that helps people, particularly here in the Northeast, with their high heating bills. Well, of course, he then proceeded to slice $300 million out of this very same program. And they try hard in city utility world, they don't like to cut off poor people in, you know, who have way behind on their bills. In the middle of winter. They try and work out deals with them so you can pay during the summer months and all kinds of things. But the fact is that that cut, as minor as it sounds in terms of the total federal budget, the $300 million cut in that one program, really did cause a fair number of people to lose heat, and three people died of hypothermia in their homes there last winter. That would be, to put it bluntly, they froze to death.
Syndicated columnist Molly Ivins, she co-authored the new book, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with syndicated columnist Molly Ivins. She lives in Texas and covered George W. Bush when he was governor. She co-authored a book about those years called Shrub. Now she's co-authored a book about the Bush presidency called Bushwhacked. I do want to ask you about something that everybody in Washington is writing and talking about, and that is whether a columnist and CNN commentator Bob Novak should be revealing the source or sources that leaked to him that the wife of Joe Wilson was a CIA operative.
Well, I, as a journalist, I would say one has an obligation to protect one's sources, and I would you would have to push me pretty far before I would change that. Now, I have, in my career, run across a situation where I would have revealed the name of an off-the-record source if I had been pushed, because it was so clear. It was a matter that involved justice and an innocent man. And I felt that my commitment to be off the record in the face of that kind of thing was not terribly important. Novak, of course, is going to have to make his own call on that. But if, indeed, six reporters were called by whoever in the administration with this information, I'm pretty confident that we can trust our professional colleagues to leak like sieves and that the information will be out in no time flat.
So you think the information will come out without Bob Novak having to
Reporters
tell who his source
leak
was?
Worse than anybody.
Really?
Oh, always. Mm-hmm. Haven't you noticed? Terry.
You've said that there are two kinds of humor. One kind makes us chuckle about our foibles and our shared humanity, like what Garrison Keillor does. The other kind holds people up to public contempt and ridicule. And you said, that's what I do. What works about that form of humor for you?
Okay, well, I think that satire is, and it's not my opinion, but you can look at the whole range of history, going back to ancient Athens, ancient Rome. Satire is a weapon, and it can be quite a cruel weapon, too. I mean, it can really injure and harm, but mostly I think it does make people laugh. It's always been a weapon of the powerless against the powerful. And so if you aim it, as I do, at politicians. I mean, I do try to remember from time to time that many of them have wives and mothers who love them. But mostly I figure, oh, hell, nobody ever held a gun to their heads and forced them to run for public office. It's not my problem. I try to reserve contempt and ridicule not only for the deserving, but the deserving who have put themselves in the public eye. In other words, we try not to hit civilians. What has worried me a bit about some of what passes for humor in recent years is that I find that it is often satire aimed at the powerless. One hears it on Rush Limbaugh and even more on the programs of Limbaugh's imitators, the little Limbaughlings who seem to exist in almost every radio market. When you aim satire at helpless people, it's not only cruel, it's profoundly vulgar.
Do you think you were ever good at nonpartisan straight reporting before you became a columnist?
Oh, sure. I've always spent years as a reporter on the street, and I'm even, not that I would claim much for that, reporters not necessarily a great and magnificent profession, barely even a trade, some would say. But I do think that there is something to be said for having spent several years of one's life doing things like going out and interviewing all five eyewitnesses to an automobile accident and then trying to write an accurate coherent account of what happened. That will give you a considerable respect for the complexity of truth. And the difficulty, you can get facts straight and let the truth go hang itself, even more unforgivably, get facts wrong. And you have to be, you learn as a reporter how to check, how to make sure, how to get it right. And what really bothers me is how many people are now political commentators who were never reporters. They have come straight off the front lines of partisan political warfare. They were campaign honchos or speech writers or aides to somebody or other. And none of them seem to have spent any time as reporters. And again, I'm not claiming much for our trade, but I do think that some respect for the difficulty of truth, just sort of not carelessly firing partisan opinion around as though all facts could be bent to a point of view.
And do you think that's what's happening now in a lot of TV and radio, that it's more about the spin than about trying to find the truth?
All the time. And those dreadful sort of gong shows where they go on it seems to be a sort of, you know, like the World Wrestling Federation or something in political drag. They go on and snipe at one another to absolutely no one's enlightenment or understanding or better comprehension of the situation. It's just annoying.
Your parents were Republicans. What were the life-changing episodes in your life that made you become a Democrat?
Oh, I think I'm a pretty classic case. You really can't talk to a Southern liberal of a certain age without the answer being race. How did you become a liberal in the South or wherever you came from? Race, race, race. I mean, that's just where I grew up in East Texas before the Civil Rights Movement, and had always thought that the way blacks were treated was wrong. I mean, it was perfectly clear to me that it was rotten and unfair and unnecessary and ugly. And not that I was, you know, when I was seven that I thought in those terms, but I did notice that my mother tried to teach me good manners, that we were breaking some of those rules when it came to black people. And so when the Civil Rights movement came along, I was part of it in a very minor way, nothing heroic. I mean, you know, it was East Texas. We had a tacky Civil Rights movement. But that experience showed me how much things can change in this country, how fast things can change in this country, what happens when people stand up and fight and scream and yell, how much difference they can make. And it showed me what an important role government can play in trying to get us a little further down the road toward liberty and justice for all.
Molly Ivins, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Syndicated columnist Molly Ivins is co-author of the new book, Bushwhacked: Life in George W. Bush's America.